Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking with you about the Royal Thai Pavilion. It's located at the Obrick Botanical Gardens in Madison, and it was gifted to the UW by the Thai government and the Thai chapter of the Wisconsin Alumni Association. I think it was back in 2001. And since then, the structure, it suffered a bit over the years from our winters, mostly, I think. But last year, a three-year restoration project was completed, and the pavilion stands as beautiful as it was when it first arrived to Madison. We'll talk about it today with a couple of people. Kimberly Santiago, one of them, Communications and Advancement Coordinator for UW-Madison's Department of Ag and Applied Economics in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. She's Director of International Alumni Relations for the Wisconsin Alumni Association. When the pavilion first came to Madison, Kimberly, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Great to see you. Also, great to see Stacy Keller with us. Stacy is a senior architect with Madison-based Insight Consulting Architects. She also serves as Secretary of the Board of Directors of the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation, which recently recognized the pavilion's restoration project. And Stacy, it's great to see you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. Very grateful to be here.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the Royal Thai Pavilion? Have you visited it? I've visited it many times over the years. What did you think? I really like it a lot. What about you? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Kimberly, let's start with you. The Thai government and the Thai chapter of the Wisconsin Alumni Association gifted the Royal Thai Pavilion to UW-Madison. Why was that gift made?
You know, the gift really signifies the gratitude of the Thai alumni for the time that they spent here at the university, also within the city of Madison and the state of Wisconsin. There's a long history of Thai students coming here to UW-Madison. That history sort of was, I guess I would say, cemented during Donna Shalala's time as chancellor. And she spent a lot of time really looking beyond the university to, you know, how the university played a role internationally. And during her tenure, she started engaging with our international alumni. And there were a number of delegations that went to Thailand, to Taiwan, to Korea. Part of that was, again, with her forward thinking, looking ahead to the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the university. So during these visits where they went abroad, they were so incredibly received by the alumni. They really hadn't, tapped into that goodwill. And so over the years, there was increasing engagement with Thailand. The gift of the Thai pavilion that sort of came in the year 2000, that the proposal of the gift was by a group of alumni that identified themselves as the Thai Badger Mafia. And they were a group of alums that were here in the 70s and were very active on campus, but also very active nationally. And when they went back to Thailand, they became very successful within the country. And they really felt that a big part of their success was due to their time here at the university.
What's the significance of the pavilion itself? I mean, there are those pavilions in Thailand. Mm-hmm. What do they signify?
You know, when the gift came or was proposed, there were a lot of discussions about the, whether this was a religious symbol or there was concern about that. But the pavilions, you'll see them all over the country.
Yeah.
And they really are a place for community to gather, for people to take a rest, just to enjoy themselves. And I think that's maybe, you know, for us here in Madison, that sense of community is something that's very special about this city.
Yes.
So the fact that the pavilion itself really is a symbol of community, I think, is makes it even that much more special for us.
You know, and it's such a beautiful setting at the Olbrich Botanical Gardens. But I'm wondering, well, I think I know the backstory, but maybe you could explain why didn't it, since it was a UW-Madison kind of gift,
mm-hmm.
why didn't it land on the Madison campus?
There are a lot of backstories to the pavilion. But in particular, when this pavilion was first proposed, it actually was after Donna Shalala, David Ward became chancellor, and yeah. he continued to build international relations abroad. And in 2000, the Wisconsin Alumni Association hosted Asia 2000, the first international alumni conference that was in Thailand. And at the end of that conference, that's when the Thai alumni proposed this gift. And they had drawings of that. And there are blueprints. I think they're still around. It was a very modest building. It was about 3 meters by 3 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And the university was very grateful for that proposal and accepted the gift. And then there was the discussion about where to put this, the pavilion, the three-meter by three-meter pavilion. And there were meetings with the chancellor's office and campus community facilities. And they decided that it was going to go down by the old surf
mm-hmm.
On the west side of campus. And there are Indian mounds there. So they also had discussions with the population here about siting it there. And they gave their approval and blessing. And the Thais actually really, that was also for them significant. They really, I think, respect the history of the indigenous population here. So anyway, the decision was to put it there, down by the surf. And myself and a former faculty member, Michael Hinden, went back to Bangkok to finally seal the deal and sign off on it. And the Thais asked us, well, would you like to see it? And we said, sure. Oh, it's already built? They said, oh, yeah, it's already built. We'll go out and see it. And so they took us out, and we saw the building that you see at Olbrich Gardens, which is not 3 meters by 3 meters.
40 feet long?
Yes. It's about 14 meters by, I think we said, 8 meters. And so we had to come back and say, you know, Houston, we have a problem. And so there was a discussion about putting it somewhere other than on campus, because campus really wasn't prepared to be able to protect it and have an appropriate setting.
But the Olbrich setting, that was masterful.
Yes, yes. That was really I think that really shows the cooperation between the campus and the city and parks.
Yeah.
And Olbrich itself, Olbrich Society.
And so you saw the building erected.
Yes.
But then it had to come apart.
That's right.
What was that? I mean, just explain that. And then
yes.
I promise, Stacey, I'll get to you here.
This is the most important part, please.
Well, in fact, that building was built 3 times before, built and deconstructed before it came over here. And it's, you know, it is done in a traditional way, so there's very little hardware that's used in the construction. Once it was decided that it would be placed at Olbrich, and that was in place, then we had to figure out how to get it shipped over here, and then also for the artisans to come over and construct it, because it's, you know, a traditional building.
No tenpenny nails in that building.
That's correct. That's correct. So it, they deconstructed it, and they were in the process of shipping it over, and we had to get the visas for the artisans, and that became another glitch in the whole process of getting getting the pavilion over here. But eventually it was shipped over. It arrived on the West Coast, and it was held up there for certain reasons, and eventually trucked over here to Madison.
And then put back together again by those same artisans?
That's correct. Yep. It's sort of, there's a backstory to everything. It was sort of a comedy of errors, but it all came together in the end.
I remember talking about it at the time that it was finally constructed. And Stacy, here we are, 20 years go by. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a building that was erected in and made for Thailand weather.
That's right. So a lot of the materials, especially the clay bodies of the terracotta roof tiles, were all made of Thailand clay. And that tropical climate, if you can imagine, those materials did not fare as well in our Wisconsin climate of freeze-thaw.
Maybe you could describe what it looks like, the building itself.
So the building's an open-air structure. It's on several pillars and then has been decoratively painted with gold leaf and decorative painting styles from Thailand. And then on top, it has a series of the clay tiles are all painted with a gold glaze. And then it has metal flashings that cover all of the edges in a very careful fashion. And then at each of the end gable ends, there are mosaic tiles.
Yeah. What was it like when you first walked into the structure? When it was constructed here on campus?
At Olbrich?
Yeah.
You know, the structure itself is jaw-dropping. It really is incredibly beautiful, and nothing that you're going to see anywhere else. It's the only one of its kind here in North America, and it is, it's stunningly beautiful. And I think one thing also, when you look at the building, so there's the beauty of it, but there's the whole beauty of the idea behind it. And then there's also, as I said, you know, there's this comedy of errors that happened with it. But it was, construction on that building was supposed to start on September 10th, and 2000.
Yeah.
And the artisans missed their plane. They were delayed. Mm-hmm. So they actually arrived on September 11th.
Yeah.
So it... you know, it has that additional symbolism. When Stacy was talking about the tiles, at the time, that was a very difficult time here in the United States. So we organized an event for the community to come and sign the tiles. So every tile on that roof, people came and wrote their good wishes or, things... hope, that type of thing. And we then did that process again for the new building during the renovation.
Let's talk some more about the renovation, Stacy. Your company is, of course, Insight Consulting Architects. You evaluated the structure. What was it the tile that needed the most help, or what was going on?
Right. So in 2021, Insight Consulting Architects was hired by the city to come take a look at it and evaluate what the challenges were for the building. The metal flashings were probably the most apparent thing in that they were a little thinner than we would use here in the Midwest and long spans. And so some of them had been flapping. But it's interesting that if you see some of the pictures that have been on the website forever, they had all these, errors or, misgivings that were happening to the building. And you still didn't notice those things, but the up-close survey that we did, the evaluations really started to find that the clay tiles from the inside of the tiles were starting to pop loose. So there were a couple holes on the backside that we were finding, and that was what brought us in to start looking at it. We started noticing some of the wood failures on kind of the end caps because they were taking in moisture. And then the other kind of interesting thing we started finding was that on the inside in the ceilings, there were paint failures happening. And then, again, through the process with the scaffolding being up close, we started noticing that the mosaic tiles were starting to fail. And although it looked fine and was, you know, somewhat gleaming still, you could see the missing tiles that were happening. So it was really those fine up-close observations that started to bring us into the knowledge that there was a little more going wrong with the structure than we had initially, you know, ever anticipated.
Talking today with Stacy Keller, Senior Architect for Madison-based Insight Consulting Architects, and with Kimberly Santiago, Communication and Advancement Coordinator for UW-Madison's Department of Ag and Life and Applied Economics in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. But she previously served as Director of International Alumni Relations for the Wisconsin Alumni Association. Talking with them about the Thai Pavilion, we've gone a little bit through the history of the pavilion, and we're going to talk some more about it and what's happened over the last couple of years to renovate and restore it. And I hope you'll join in. Have you visited the Thai Pavilion? What'd you think? Questions about it? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Talking today with Kimberly Santiago and Stacy Keller. They have a lot of knowledge and have done a lot of work relating to the Thai Pavilion, which is located at Olbrich Botanical Gardens on Madison's west side. You're not going to find one anywhere else in the U.S., I don't believe. In fact, I'm sure of it. And if you haven't seen it, you should definitely visit, especially now since it's undergone its restoration. We're talking about the restoration with Stacy and Kimberly. And again, I hope you'll join in. Questions or comments, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That gold leaf was the gold. When I think gold leaf, is it gold paint? Gold. Talk about that.
It is sheets of actual gold that are hammered into these very fine sheets. They apply a resinous material to the wood and then actually just tap it all into place so it adheres to the structure, and it's a very tedious process. That if people saw the news, there was a lot of images of the artisans that actually do this, and they have the most patience to just do it yeah. one step at a time, and it's beautiful work.
Yeah, it's a lot more patience than I have. Well, the restoration started in 2021. Who did the work on that?
So Insight Consulting Architects began the process of evaluations, as well as determining the process for, I'll just say, providing the hidden techniques for the construction documents that we could bid out for the city. And then Kalam was the winning construction company that was who performed the work.
And I'm wondering, I'm sure there were some traditional building methods applied during the restoration, but talk about those.
Sure. So at Insight Consulting Architects, we specialize in historic preservation as well as these traditional building techniques. And we are very familiar with the artisans, the manufacturers, the suppliers of all these types of materials in order to do that. So our group really did a lot of deep research in finding out the right clay tile bodies that they should use, how to make it matching, We work very closely with Kalam on how to bend the metals and make shorter spans so things could expand and contract a little more. We worked with Kalam as well on those decorative painting processes, as well as some of those gold leaf techniques. And then Kalam also brought in a gentleman named Josh Weiner from the East Coast, and he actually had trained in Thailand to help on the mosaic tile replacement. So it was a great collaboration of artisans, suppliers. Steve even went to Germany. There's another pavilion in Germany that we started to work with those people on how to provide the access to things and some of the techniques. So there was a lot of research involved on our part to provide those great restoration pieces.
There was also consulting with the original artisans as well, and the Ministry of Fine Arts. So there was additional collaboration with on the Thai side with some of the alumni who had been involved, and also with the artisans themselves.
Yeah, and yeah. Kim was that great conduit to have for them. They were part of the stakeholder group, so we were really always collaborating on those decisions.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We were having some technical difficulties in a way with our phone situation, but they seem to be resolved now, and we have a number of people who would like to visit with you. And if you don't get in, you can also email us. The email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Charles in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in historic preservation, and I understand there's tax credits in state and federal tax credits for preserving historic properties. This, I guess, is a historic property, but there weren't tax credits, I assume, in the city-owned. But what would a private, what type of programs are there for private homeowners or commercial building owners that want to preserve?
Yeah, Stacy?
So, yeah, this project did not qualify for a lot of those things.
Sure.
Working through the process, you do have to have a registered property to qualify for those things. But there are programs out there. Just reach out to the Historical Society. They have 20% tax credits through the state, and then there's also federal tax credits for historic properties.
So the Wisconsin Historical Society, you're saying, is a great starting point for this?
Yeah, their website will give you all the links to all those things, but it goes towards those construction projects for windows, roofs, things that are attached to the building. It'll help offset some of those costs and investments, even restoring historic windows.
Yeah, which could be an expensive little proposition for certain. So
yes.
There you go. Thank you, Charles, very much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Stacy, you nominated the project for the Restoration Award. The pavilion actually won.
Right. So I do sit on the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation Board, but that only gave me privy to when the dates of submission were. I am not part of, just to be really clear, not part of the selection committee or the selection of the selection members for this. I'm, you know, just
to be
there
to, make that
to
point.
Support it. But yeah, the Historic Trust or Madison Trust for Historic Preservation, they advocate for preservation in the greater Madison area. And so we were very proud to be considered for this award. This project runs a fine line of whether it's historic, but it's certainly a landmark structure in Madison, as well as using all those traditional building techniques that aren't on modern projects. So we're very grateful to the Trust for recognizing the diligent work that we all participated on for this project.
Let's take a call from Mary Ann, who's en route to La Crosse on the phone and in the car, probably. Mary Ann, hi.
Okay, I'll call back. Hello?
All right, Marianne, are you there?
Yes. I am going to call back in a couple minutes when I have a better signal.
Oh, you sound pretty good right now.
Am I? Okay. All right, I'll talk. I was at the pavilion yesterday, and the restoration was immaculate. It was absolutely beautiful. The reflecting pool, all the gold. It was just a glorious. I stayed in the building, and then I just stayed by the reflecting pool a while. And I wanted to also say that my very first time there was with a Thai friend of mine who was studying here for his MBA. And when he graduated, he wanted me to see that structure. And he was so proud of it. It was emotional. He just said, you know, have you seen the Thai structure? And I had not. So he wanted to share that. And he had a lot of pride for what they have given us. And it's beautiful.
Oh, thank you, Marianne, for calling. Comment, Kimberly?
You know, thank you very much, Marianne, for sharing that story. I don't know when that student was here, but, you know, the Thais themselves, the students, the alumni, and the Thai community, there's a part of their heart is within that structure. When, again, going back to the tiles, for the original structure, when the tiles were placed on the roof, we invited the Thai students here on campus and the members of the community to come and help actually put the tiles on. So there was, you know, like a bucket line.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone could have a hand on that tile as they went up onto the roof. So there's, you know, there's a part of our community and our alumni embedded also into that structure.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. Stacey?
Remember, for this restoration process, we went through the same thing. And
yep.
We had over 1,400 tiles
signed
on the backside. So again, you'll never see them until the you know, the timed capsule structure of it, right, as
mm-hmm.
well.
Marianne, thank you again. Appreciate your call. Deborah in Middleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I'm wondering, since they had to do the remediation because the materials weren't up to snuff for Wisconsin winter and climate, while they were doing the restoration, did they use materials that would be more accommodating to our climate here so that they don't have to redo it again in another 20 years?
You're right. We did. We did have to, because of the challenges that were happening and could continue to fail, we replaced 100% of those clay tiles with a northern body clay. But we were able to replicate the body color to be the golden color as well as the glazes to match identically. So you won't ever really know that it's really a change. We also put in some weather barriers underneath the tiles in order to prevent that wind-driven snow from getting into the attics and causing those additional paint failures that we were kind of surprised to see.
What happened to the clay tiles that then were, I mean, they were not usable anymore, but was there anything done with any of the clay tiles that were taken off?
The Olbrich has kept some of them. And they are going to create an exhibit of some of the tiles. There's, you know, there are plans right now. So in 2027, we'll celebrate 25 years of the pavilion, and Olbrich will be celebrating 75 years of the garden. So there are plans in place for some type of exhibit, but I think that's still in process right now.
Yeah, but I'm glad.
Yes.
I'm glad some of those were saved.
All of those tiles were taken off by hand individually, and then when they found the signatures on the back, crated for saving of this use. So it was very careful attention deconstructing and reconstructing the project.
Susie in Manitowoc, we go to you now. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a comment. I have a comment and just a thank you for having these really, really interesting women on as guests. My comment is we live in Manitowoc, but when our boys were in college, we visited the Obrecht Gardens often. And she's right, Stacy is right. It is awesomely beautiful if you've never seen it before. And we have pictures of our five-month-old grandson being held up and by his dad, and pictures taken of the pavilion with the two of them in it. So thank you for the information. Never knew all of that background of it. It's really interesting. And we got to get back down there and see the restoration, because we haven't been there since they graduated.
Susie, thank you very much for calling. Comment, Stacy?
Well, I'd just say I wanted to make sure that everyone knew that the Thai Festival is going to be taking place September 14th. It's in conjunction with the Thai Consulate and Obrecht Gardens and City of Madison Parks and UW. So the kind of grand reopening of it with all the gardens in place will be taking place. And there'll be music and dancing and
food,
crafts and food.
Yep.
And so, that's, again, September?
September 14th.
Sunday,
September 14th.
Yeah, from 11 to 4.
But in the meantime, if you're in town now.
Anytime is a good time.
Stop by anytime.
Yes, anytime is a good time.
It's, maybe we could talk for just a minute about, the building just isn't sitting there all by its lonesome.
No, it's not.
Talk about what one sees in addition to, I mean, it's the setting and the way things are created around it really adds, to my mind, adds so much to the experience.
Yeah, there was a lot of thought put into setting the pavilion at Olbrich Gardens. So when you approach it, and it's, when you approach the pavilion, first you're going to cross a bridge. And if you look at the bridge structure even, there's a lot of thought that was put into the style, the design of the bridge. And as you come up to approach the bridge, that's the beginning, if you look at the ground, the beginning of the naga or the serpent. So it's actually a serpent design that will lead you to the pavilion. As you cross the bridge, you'll get a perfect, incredible view of the pavilion and the reflecting pool that's in front of it. So, one of the callers mentioned that. The reflecting pool is planted with lotus. And then actually surrounding the pavilion, you'll see a number of statuary. And some of those were sent originally with the pavilion. But then one in particular, there's an elephant there that was a gift from one of the princesses of the royal family who has visited Madison twice.
Isn't it? It's absolutely amazing. And somebody else is wondering, well, how long is it going to last before it needs more work?
So the new tiles we typically say are about 30 to 50 year tiles. That's what if we were putting in a new structure, that's what we would anticipate for its longevity. And those flashings we did in a different way in order to, again, a little more freeze thaw. And, you know, paint is always going to need maintenance, but we're working with them on a ongoing process. So,
what kind of paint do they use for that? I mean, it's
an enamel type of paint that's part of the reds and the blacks, and then again the gold leaf is on there. Some of the lower railing pieces we did put into like a gold resin paint, again, to kind of be more resistant to some of those finger prints that go through it. But again, all hopefully you'll never know that anything has changed.
Stacy, you might want to talk about the special way that you went to prevent birds actually from...
Well, yeah, so Kalam had a really interesting experience in working with all the birds that were on there. We put up nailers. One of the gentlemen, he was on the project the entire time, started making custom nails to try to prevent them, but they still somehow kept making bedding areas into all of this. And that was during the construction, of course. So we kept a lot of trial and error and ended up discovering that there's some baking soda laundry components, balls that you put in, and they don't like that smell. So we're hopeful that you, again, won't ever see them because they're kind of tucked in some of the corners, but we're hoping to prevent some of those birds from nesting on the pavilion and causing some of that paint damage again.
Well, I tell you what, it is a fantastic sight, fantastic place, and you guys deserve a lot of thanks for all of your work on this. So I appreciate very much you taking the time to be with us today.
It was a great collaboration, I think. Yeah. A lot of partners and a lot of thought, heart, and soul went into the project, and we encourage anyone to get out there and see it.
Well, 30 years from now, when it needs to be redone.
Again,
we'll have you back.
We wish you well.
Maybe we'll do it before that.
I'll still be working, so we'll just keep those maintenance projects, keeping it well. So thank you.
Kim, Stacy, thank you both so much. Kimberly Santiago, Communication and Advancement Coordinator at UW-Madison. She previously served as Director of International Alumni Relations for the Wisconsin Alumni Association when this was all first taking place. Stacy Keller, Senior Architect with Madison-based Insight Consulting Architects. She's also Secretary of the Board of Directors for the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation. Great fun talking with them, and I'll look forward to visiting with them down the road, 30 years from now for sure. But maybe sooner than that. You know, another guy who's been around a long time is Fred Risser. And Fred's written a new book about his time in service to Wisconsin. And we're going to talk with him next. Fred and Doug Moe, my old pal, next here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. In 2020, when then Wisconsin Senator Fred Risser decided not to run for re-election, no legislator in U.S. history had a longer career. He's now written an autobiography about his 64 years in the state capitol, Larry Mueller here, and he's in the studio today with me. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And Doug Moe, my old pal.
Hi, Larry.
Who co-wrote this. Doug has worked as a journalist and biographer in Wisconsin for what, 40 years?
Yeah, over 40 now.
It's amazing. Well, and together, the two wrote Forward for the People. That's the title. Forward for the People is Fred's account of his decades in the state legislature, and I'm telling you, it's a fascinating read. And as we talk with Doug and Fred today, I hope you'll join in. Do you have a memory of meeting or working with retired Senator Fred Risser? He probably shook your hand once, at least once.
Yeah.
If you're from this district in the Madison area, do you have questions maybe about state politics and how they've changed over time? They certainly have, and it was really fascinating for me to kind of read through the changes that have taken place and also what Fred did in the 240 or plus bills that he had authored and actually got enacted during his time. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Fred, when you retired from the state Senate 2021, if I'm not mistaken, you were the longest serving legislator in U.S. history. I've been around a little bit too for a while. And I wonder, did you ever just think, how the heck did this all happen?
No, I never anticipated when I started out.
Yeah.
It was a part-time job. Now it became a sort of a full-time job. Times changed, and the whole ball game changed. The politics has changed tremendously. And the period I had is so much different than what it is now. I don't think I could function in the current setup.
Yeah, we can talk about that a bit more. Doug, how did you and Fred come to work together on this?
I think it was at a Fair Wisconsin luncheon some years ago, and I had just done a book with former Governor Thompson.
Yeah.
And, Senator Risser said, how does this happen? You hire someone like you, probably, right? And when the Tommy's book came out, I sent one to Fred, and we ended up working. It was during the pandemic, so it was an interesting time. But maybe we'll get into this, Larry. But Senator Risser had the most incredible archive of letters from his time in the Navy, his time in law school at Oregon. So we were able to, I think, really summon detail of his early life that was amazing. There's a photo in the book of December 7th, 1941, of his mom or his dad and Fred and his brother looking at a globe to find Hawaii. it was a great journey.
It's got to be a little bit difficult. I mean, to encapsulate this guy's career in a book.
I got I got my start by having a chance to observe President at the time, President Roosevelt. I had a chance to see him. He made a speech. He's running for the fourth term that time, and I was a young kid. He made a speech down in Chicago and the Mayor Daley handed out two or three tickets for every seat to be sure the space is filled. And he went to Chicago, hitchhiked down there, visited a friend of mine, and got to the chance to actually see Roosevelt. So that was my start.
And I got to tell you, you come from a long line here of family members who've served Wisconsin in the legislature.
That's true. In fact, I'm the fourth generation, and I'm the fourth political party representing this area.
Which I thought was pretty cool, too.
Yeah, I'm the only Democrat that was ever elected. My dad spent three terms as a progressive when the progressives were in control. My grandfather, Ernest Warner, after whom Warner Park is named, served as a Republican, a progressive Republican, sort of low-violent Republican. And then my great-grandfather, the one that lost an arm in the Civil War, was originally elected as a Unionist and then subsequently as a Republican. And they all represented this area. In fact, it's in the book, and I think it mentions that my mother is probably the only woman who was the granddaughter of a legislator, the daughter of a legislator, the wife of a legislator, and the mother of a legislator. So I do have a family background.
Oh, and yet you went to Oregon to get your law degree.
Yes, well, I wanted to be my own self. And rather than my dad's son, I wanted to go to Oregon. Of course, I love Oregon. It's a beautiful countryside. And I had a chance to go there as I was roaming around the countryside. And so that's where I got my law degree. And then I came back to Madison and passed the bar exam here. It was a great experience.
And went to work with your dad.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to for a short time, and then I was going to go back maybe to Oregon, but I got settled down in Madison, and here I am.
Well, and then the mayor, Ivan Nestegan, he was in the assembly, but the mayor's office opened up, So he became mayor and then opened up an assembly seat for you, right, Senator?
That's right. I lived downtown, and I did not live at home. I picked up an old building and renovated it and lived downtown because I wanted to live by myself. And downtown area had an assemblyman Nestigan, popular man, and he decided to run for mayor. And so I decided to help get elected because if he got elected, maybe I could run for his seat.
Right.
And we elected him, and I ran for his seat. And so next is a couple of years in the assembly and went on and on.
Well, that first time you ran for that assembly seat, you campaigned really hard. I remember, and maybe I'm confusing dates and times here, but I remember you talking about campaigning for like 24 hours straight.
Yes, we tried a 24-hour period, day and night, because you could meet people at nighttime that you don't meet in the daytime. And so,
Horace Wilkie,
you
went, who was running for the state Senate, eventually Supreme Court Justice Wilkie. But.
Yeah, we went together. We went all night long. And by the way, you meet people at night that you wouldn't meet in the daytime. So
they
it was a good
too.
Idea.
Well, 3 a.m. or so, you kind of wonder who you're meeting then, but...
They had night shifts.
Yeah, at 3 a.m. they never see a politician. They're sleeping during the daytime. Anyway, no, we campaigned pretty hard day and night. I think it helped because my opponent was a very good man, and his wife was the executive secretary of the Democratic Party. So I wasn't anointed with the Democrats at the time. I had to prove my way.
You do talk about, you mentioned wives. You do talk about wives and the importance of wives in campaigning and so forth.
It's absolutely necessary. I would not consider running for office if my wife wasn't 100% supportive. It's and they're very, very important. Don't underestimate the power of a woman.
One of the ironies of the earliest campaigns, when I was going through the senator's archive, I found matchbooks with his face and name on it. And, of course, Fred became pretty famous later on for discouraging the use of matchbooks.
Everyone smoked back in those days.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I was really fascinated with and caused me to say, we actually didn't, you know, for example, the smoking, you had the first bill.
Yes, years and years ago. I introduced the bills over and over again. It was a long fight. Originally I introduced a bill. I thought if you cut smoking out under 16, and I remember in the legislature, a legislator got up and says, "You mean to tell me you're going to keep the kids from buying cigarettes for the old man?" And they beat the bill down at that time.
But you got it eventually.
Eventually, first 16, then adults, and then out of restaurants, and then in restaurants. And our final bill actually was further than most bills are in the United States. They outlaw smoking in recreation areas where your motels don't.
And bars and restaurants have seemed to survive pretty well. There was talk they were going to all,
all
fail.
Die away. I'm telling you right now, I think most people are appreciative of the fact that you don't have to, even if you're a smoker, it's nice to have a place where the smoke isn't there. Fred Risser and Doug Moe are guests today. And we are going to take a quick look at the news and come back to you. But we're talking with Fred and Doug about their book. It's titled Forward for the People, the Autobiography of America's Longest-Serving Legislator. Got a lot more stories to tell. Marvin and Menominee, I hope you can stay along and get your question in after this look at the news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. About a week ago, I finished reading the book Forward for the People, the autobiography of America's longest-serving legislator, written by Fred Risser, an autobiography along with writer Doug Moe. And I've got both Doug and Fred in the studio with me to talk about the book and to talk about Fred's life. And certainly, if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call or two here. Marvin in Menominee's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Marvin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you. And Senator Risser and Mr. Moe, thank you very much for being on. And Senator Risser, thank you for your dedicated service to the constituents of Wisconsin. I'm from Waupaca, Wisconsin, originally, and so is Joe Leon. He was one of my teachers in high school. Okay.
Well, he was a Republican legislator. I remember him very well.
He was a decent man, and
you're right. I want to interrupt. He was a decent man. They had a lot of decent Republicans in those days. I can't say as much now. But anyway, I remember him very well. We served in the Senate together. And actually, I think we participated in several bills together. In those days, the Democrats and Republicans got together on bipartisan efforts. And it was a much different attitude than it is today.
Yeah. Marvin, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, former State Representative Bill Lorge,
yes,
is with us. Let's go to Representative Bill Lorge. Bill, hello.
How are you doing?
Just great.
Yep. Yeah, great to hear from you. Hello, Fred. Hi, yeah. Doug.
Hello.
Yes, I'm high. How are you doing?
Just great. I think of you all the time. Your kids were the same age as me and my brother and sisters, and we grew up kind of together. You were like an uncle to me, Fred. You were at my parents' wedding.
I was, yes, and I remember your dad so well. He served in the legislature for many years.
Yeah, 34, four in the Assembly and three in the Senate with you, and we traveled quite a bit together. I remember you used to throw me up in the air in the swimming pool.
Yes, well, that's true. But he was a fine man. Those days, as I say, we had many good Republicans, and they were wonderful to work with. I enjoyed that activity, bipartisan, quite often. We had our partisan fights, but we would get together after hours and oftentimes during hours. It's a wonderful experience that I enjoyed, though I don't think I'd enjoy it too much these days.
Thank you very much for calling. Let's take another call. Dennis in Madison. Your turn, Dennis. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Dennis Winters here. I'm a lifelong resident of the city, and I very much appreciate the work you have done over the years. I met you a few times, and thanked you then. And Doug, I know you've done a lot for us too, with the documenting the people and personalities that have been active in our area. So I just wanted to call and thank you both for your service.
Well, thank you for your comments. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And just do you, for a minute, Doug, you've spent a majority of your career in Madison, and there are, I mean, I want to give you a shout out because your work with the people that you have worked with, with Tommy Thompson,
Mike Leckrone.
Mike Leckrone. I mean, really helping to let people know about the lives of these folks.
Yeah, it's been a privilege, really, because these are important to me. They're important Wisconsin stories.
Well, now, you know, I will say, you know, Doug is a professional, and I needed him to put this together, and I wouldn't have put together without him. So
That's really kind of you, Senator. it's not always easy. Somebody once said that getting two people together to write a book is like getting three people together to make a baby. things can go wrong.
Wouldn't have happened without your expertise. And when I thought of the idea, the first thing I had to do was to find someone that knew what was going on. And you're the man.
Well, we had some fun doing it.
Well, I got to tell you, there, as I looked at the bills, and you have 240 bills for sure, and so many of them, I thought, this seems like it would be just natural that anybody would want to have seat belts, for example.
Some of those bills had a hard time in the legislature, and some of those maybe passed a couple hundred, but there's a couple hundred I never passed. You lose a lot, but the effort is wonderful when you work for what you think is the best.
Well, so why would anybody have been against seatbelts? I mean, it took you a while to get that passed.
Yes, that's true.
What was the argument?
I think it was a personal responsibility thing, just like motorcycle helmets, right? and we have a story there.
Yeah. What's that story?
Well, that's the one time I was hung in effigy on the Capitol Square. They didn't put that picture in the book, but I have a picture where I was hung in effigy because I was supporting helmets for motorcycles. And the motorcycle group didn't like it. And they did not want to be forced to wear helmets. And they, by the way, they were successful in the bill. They were successful in defeating the bill that required helmets. Now, as one who's had trouble biking and having a helmet save his life, I can't understand why anyone would be against it. But there are some people that don't want it, and they were successful. And that's one of the cases I lost.
Well, I was thinking back, it was about 10 years ago, and I went over my handlebars and cracked my helmet in two.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank goodness you had it.
thank goodness I had it.
Yeah, I got a cracked helmet as a, too, as a souvenir.
One of the things that you were really interested in and really wanted had to do with building projects and keeping the state capitol as the state capitol. At one time, I guess it was being discussed that we ought to turn it into a museum.
That's correct. The capitol was built back in 1917. It's getting old and needed repairs, and was expensive, and some people actually thought, well, maybe it'd be cheaper just to turn it into a museum and build a new building from scratch. But I was very interested in maintaining it. And back in all the 64 years I was in the legislature, I represented the state capitol. They changed my district many times in reapportionment, but I was always able to keep the capitol in my district. And I felt strongly that the capitol should be the seat of state government.
Well, and that last renovation, that took over a decade, didn't it?
It took many years and many different presidents and many, many different governors. And you had to re-educate every governor, and you had to re-educate every legislative session, because new people came in and they'd say, this is too expensive. It cost over $150 million of money back in those days, but it was well worth it. But the Capitol put in air conditioning. Capitol was not air conditioned when I started out. And I remember people was opposed to air conditioning. They say, we want the legislators to get out of there, so keep it out. So anyway, it's been a great journey, and I've enjoyed it.
Well, and so you served on that building committee for a good share of your time in service. And I'll just mention in passing that in 1969, you got the building committee to approve the building we're sitting in right now.
Vilas, that's right.
Vilas Hall.
The building commission did approve it. I remember the struggle, because every time you talk about a building, people start on the other side, well, maybe it isn't necessary. Maybe it's going to cost too much. And sometimes is difficult to accomplish things. But I've enjoyed it. I was on the building commission for over 50 years. And this building and many buildings in Madison and the university.
And really worked hard, Senator, to keep state office buildings downtown, right? That became a issue.
That was one of my goals. I was I opposed the building out on the far west side, increased traffic and so forth and so on. But we were able to maintain state office facilities downtown. Though I think times have changed now. You have computers now. We didn't have computers back in those days. We have communication that's much easier to handle from distance than we had then. And so times change and so conditions change. And that's one thing those of us who've been in the legislature for a long time realize.
So one of the things, you know, I remember my dad always saying he felt like the state legislature should be a part-time job.
It was a part-time job when I started.
It should stay a part-time job, he thought.
No, when I started out, I was active as an attorney, and the legislature was supposed to meet for less than 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, they'd adjourn sine die, meaning they go back to the regular job for the next couple years. And when I started, that was it. But now the legislature never adjourns sine die. It's on all the time. And when I started out, there were no full-time legislators unless they were retired. But now, almost all the legislators consider them full-time, and their main source of income and activity is legislative.
It's full, yeah. In the state Senate, a top priority of yours was advocating for civil rights and social justice. Fair housing comes to mind, I think. But what did you see?
I always thought being in the legislature was to help people and to make society a greater place to live in. And I used to ask myself, now, does this bill help people? Is it a good bill? Is it good for society? Now times people talk about bills as whether it's going to help them or help their party. But we used to look at things differently. I felt that the part-time legislature was very good at that time, though I admit that times have changed.
Well, look at the faces of the legislature mm-hmm. compared to when you started in terms of there weren't any women, right?
Well,
people of color.
When I started in the Senate, I was there had not been any women senators over 100 years. And in fact, there no women worked in the Senate. They were all men. They didn't even have a woman's John on the Senate floor because they didn't need it. They had no women, no myths. And that has all changed. The legislature makeup has changed. We have non-whites in the legislature, mm-hmm. what we never had before. Especially. So times have changed, and it's
good and some of it less good.
Some of it's good and some of it's not good. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot we can talk about. I go back to things like the smoking ban and the seatbelt ban. There was another one a bill that you authored a few times and finally got it through. I think it was in 1976, the bill that you authored and finally got passed. It was giving unmarried people the right to buy contraceptives in Wisconsin. So before 1976, it was illegal for somebody who wasn't married to buy a contraceptive.
That's right. We were one of the last states in the Union, by the way, to allow contraceptives to be sold to non-married people. I have a very important human rights, and I had a lifetime award from the Planned Parenthood for my activities in their respects. But I've always thought that government should stay out of the politics, stay out of certain things, stay out of human relations, and to the point where they interfere with them. That's something.
Amazing to me. You were, you know, just in the news today, just in the news today, we see legislators from Texas going to Illinois, of all places, to prevent a vote by the Texas legislature, and I think it had to do with gerrymandering. And when was it? In 2011?
About 10 years ago.
No, almost 15
years. 15 years ago.
Yeah. 15, by golly. Yeah. Time goes fast.
You were among 14 Senate Democrats who left the state for Illinois.
That's right.
To prevent a vote on Governor Walker's bill.
Governor Walker Act 10, which was to, in effect, take bargaining rights away from the state employees, among other things. And we did it. We made a thing of it. I think we made our point clear. We came back, and we wouldn't do it again. I think it's something we tried once, and I think it served its purpose. But I don't really think that's the best way to run things. I think a better way would be to elect good legislators.
You were away for a month.
Yes, just about.
Doug, you got to remember and report it on, I'm sure, the public turmoil that resulted during that time period.
Well, absolutely. And the thing that was so helpful for us doing the book was that Senator Risser, of all the Fab 14, he took detailed notes. I probably at the end of each day, Senator.
I had almost 100 pages of notes.
Yeah. So I, you know, it sounds boastful, I suppose, but I do think that our chapter there is probably as good an account of that time. And it was tough at times. There were personal problems. You know, one of the senators was quite pregnant at the time. I mean, there was all kinds of things going on, and just leaving town wasn't all that easy.
Yeah, it was an amazing time. Thinking back, though, you over the years, you led some delegations. You led one to Russia. What was the purpose of that trip? Do you remember?
Well, actually, I went to Soviet Union once and Russia once. They're different things. Mm-hmm. the first one I went to was with the Friendship Group. And we had then it was the Soviet Union, and we met people on the Russian side, and quite frankly, it was a fair time. The Russians are human beings just like we are. The people in Russia, in my opinion, were interested in their country and what they're doing, and they'd ask questions about why the United States was trying to run things and so forth and so on. But those days, I'm afraid, are over for a while. It seems to me that a mixture of areas is good. I think that it would be nice if people would allow more travel and have an opportunity to visit other countries and have people in other countries, because people are basically the same. It's sometimes the governments are the ones causing the problems.
you got that right. You said what was the worst thing you said about politics was the process was gerrymandering.
Yes, and now it looks like Texas is going to try something entirely different. There you want to change the basic districts, not once every 10 years, but now, so they can have more of their Republicans in the United States Congress. I think that's outrageous. So the Supreme Court has sort of washed its hands of reapportionment, used to get involved, but now they sort of leave it to the states, which is not too good when the states are going the way they are. I think reapportionment is very important if you look at it right, if you reapportion on the basis of equality, not on the basis of politics.
And that's, to be fair, it's nonpartisan in the way that there are Democratic states that, mm-hmm. you know, are pretty gerrymandered.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a power issue. It's not a, you know, political.
You wonder about, now, Iowa, for example, I think has...
They had a good program of reapportionment. And I think their state is pretty well apportioned.
And I think, yeah, and it would be, many people have said, why can't we do it kind of the way Iowa did it, which is...
We tried, but that failed. In fact, during my tenure and there, we never did solve the reapportionment problem. In fact, the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, reapportioned the legislature on two separate occasions. And I think it's important for democracy that we allow people to express themselves and that they have an opportunity, regardless of their political party, to have an opportunity to elect Pillmans.
I just want to jump in and say that I hope that part of our book delves into the senator's personal life as well. And you've had a very happy marriage with Nancy.
Yes, I've had extremely happy marriages. No, we're celebrating our 40th wedding anniversary next week.
Yep. And I want to mention that, and you mentioned this in the book, that you never took the elevator in the state capitol building. You took the steps every day of your 64 years there.
Yes, I never rode the elevator at the state capitol, anytime. In fact, I think that's good, and I suggest it to my colleagues, and some of them are following suit, because, you know, actually... you sit too much at that time. You got to move around. You got to get that body moving around.
And I think you said it was faster to take the steps anyway.
Probably. It is. In many cases, you don't have to wait for the elevator to come around, and you could walk up the steps faster, yeah. No, never rode the elevator in 64 years.
And I want to mention one more, just as we close here. This has been such a wonderful time talking with you, but you rode your bike a mile for every year you were born in one day around your birthday.
That's right.
And you quit the last time you did it, you were...
91.
You went 91 miles.
Yep.
You rode your bike 91 miles at the age of 91.
That's right. But I didn't make it to 92. I ran into a car. So now I bike indoors instead of outdoors.
Well, this is a fantastic book, Doug and Fred. Thank you both so much. Fred, you're...
Well, thank you for having me to enjoy
You're both institutions.
Thanks,
thank
Larry.
It's been a lot of fun. The book is titled Forward for the People, The Autobiography of America's Longest-Serving Legislator, and you're going to find a lot of things in this book that we didn't get around to talking about today that you're going to be somewhat surprised at. Sometimes you'll laugh a little bit, and sometimes you might even cry a little bit as well. Fred Risser and Doug Moe, our guests, thank you for being with us on WPR News. And coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the Big Top Chautauqua. I'm Larry Mueller. For nearly 40 years, Lake Superior Big Top Chautauqua has entertained summer residents and tourists in the Bayfield, Wisconsin area. It's a 900-seat tent, has hosted original productions, regional acts, and performers well-known. Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Loretta Lynn, B.B. King, who else? Merle Haggard, Joan Baez, lots of folks. And today we're talking about the Big Top and what's going on there with a couple of guests for you. One, Gary Shaw is executive director of the Ashwaubé Alliance, which includes Big Top Chautauqua and the Mount Ashwaubé Ski Recreation Area in Bayfield. Gary, welcome.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Thank you. And I'm also delighted to get to see Mary Mack, a comedian who will bring her variety show, the Mary Mack and North Star Comedy Hour, to Big Top Chautauqua on Friday, August 8th. Mary, thank you for joining us as well. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm a big fan, Larry, and I'm super excited to be part of the Larry, Gary, and Mary show today.
Larry, Gary, Mary show. There we go. Oh, man. As we talk with our two guests, yeah. I hope you'll join in. Have you attended a summer concert or a show at Big Top Chautauqua outside Bayfield? What was that experience like for you? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Gary, first let's talk about Big Top Chautauqua. First, there are people who are listening and say, what the heck is Big Top Chautauqua? What is Big Top Chautauqua?
Well, we're the best kept secret in the North Woods, honestly. We're up here near Bayfield, just outside of Bayfield. We sit up on Ski Hill Road on the Mount Ashwaubé site. So during the winter, we have downhill and cross-country skiing, probably some of the best cross-country skiing in the North Woods. And during the summer, the Big Top sits on top of the mountain. And we, again, as you said, have 900 seats inside the tent and as well as lawn seating outside. So you can be looking at the stars or the moon, as it was big and bright last night, even through the haze of the smoke, and see some of the most amazing bands, both regionally and nationally. So it has really been great.
It's been going on since what? World War One?
It seems like it. 1986. We're celebrating 39 years. Next year is our big 40th anniversary. We're very excited about it. And we hope people will join us for the end of our 39th and look at what's coming up for next year as we announce.
You know, what I was thinking, when I said World War One, I think it goes back. There were tent shows back in those days, and I guess you're sort of remembering that history through Big Top.
Yeah, so the Chautauquas actually go back to the mid 1800s. They started out as actually education for school Sunday school teachers, and they were a place for Sunday school teachers to come and get educated. And the Chautauqua then continued to expand and include recreation, education, entertainment, and then obviously the other things that went along with some of the pieces that we think today may be a little bit too political, but it created whole communities. And then that morphed into, in the early 1900s, yes, these traveling Chautauquas. With the advent of railroad, these tent shows would make their way around a region. And so we had a Chautauqua in this region at that time, and across the country, 1,700 at one point, wow, traveling the country and putting on shows, putting up their tent in town after town. With the advent of the automobile, the railroad Chautauquas went away, but we still have, I believe it's 29 Chautauquas across the country, some associated with communities that have been there for years, or others like ours that are independent and cater to a region rather than a small community. Yeah. So it's got a long and very rich history.
And the events bring people, well, it's not only just local people coming.
No, we had someone drive in on Saturday night from Montana, somebody from Ohio, They come from all over the country and honestly, all over the world if they're traveling through the area to be able to see some of these artists. That one other thing that I see performers really loving, Larry, is that, you know, they're on the road for weeks and weeks at a time. They're going from city to city. They're in concrete jungles, really. And they just love coming up here. They love being able to take a hike or down to Lake Superior or to take a boat ride. They really love that we serve them homemade food, local fish, local vegetables, local fruit. And, you know, for them, it's really a treat to have a day where they're not just cooped up in a hotel room. They're not just going down to get the fast food at the place next door or hotel food, which has to get old very quickly. So the experience that they really get in our hospitality and being able to just take a day to really relax and just really calm down, I think they really appreciate that venue being actually in the woods away from everything else.
And I think we got Mary back. Mary, are you there?
I am back. I appreciate that the Big Top is just 30 miles from my house. And you can go fishing between sound check and the show. That's not always possible in places like LA or New York City. You know that, Larry?
Well, you're bringing your North Country Comedy Hour back under the Big Top this Friday, August 8th. And, you know, to me, and I haven't seen it, but to me, it sounds like such a hoot. For those who haven't seen it, talk about what they can expect.
Well, it's basically like a mini festival in one show. I pull my hair out producing this thing and hosting and writing for it. It's like a sketch, and I have three bands, and I have game shows and sometimes poetry, and I'm on stage interacting with all of these performers. I make them come from everywhere. We're having two acts from Chicago, and it is cool, like Gary said, when these Chicago performers come up and they see the beauty they're in, and it's so much fun. It's my passion project. It's kind of like Carol Burnett meets the North Woods. I've been doing it since 2007, but the last few years I've done it on a much larger scale, and it's all recorded for podcast and potential video cast as well.
And I would say, given the way you describe it too, it's a family-friendly kind of show.
Oh yeah, I've been told I don't swear enough, Larry. I'm working on it, though.
Oh, man. Jim in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Been attending shows at Big Top for, I don't know, the last 15 years or so. I try to get up once a year from Stevens Point. The music is great. The venue is wonderful. The air just flows through the Big Top on a nice, cool day. You're up by the lake. Bayfield's a great place, and there just isn't really a better place in Wisconsin to hear music than Big Top Chautauqua.
Jim, thanks.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not getting anybody arguing with you about that, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Gary, you're the executive director of the Ashuapa Alliance. What is that?
So the Ashuapa Alliance is the kind of the umbrella. I'm not going to use the word tent. It's in the umbrella that underneath is the Mount Ashuapa Recreation Area. So our year-round recreational events that happen up on the hill or in the surrounding lands around it, including the Nordic skiing and downhill skiing during the summer. It's biking and hiking. It is the Big Top Chautauqua. So during the summer, all these wonderful events that we see going on at the tent. It is also the backstage. It's a little small cabaret style room that we have here in Bayfield. Most famous for its open mic. It has an amazing Wednesday night open mic, which is free. And we get acts from all over the Midwest and that come up and want to try out their things. Every once in a while, you'll even find Mary Mack at the open mic at the backstage. And then finally, we finally, we have Stage North, which is in Washburn, just south of us. And that is a theater-style venue that we have music and films and theater in the lobby and in the theater. So we have an array of ways that people can engage with us. And again, in true Chautauqua form, recreation, education, and entertainment is really our core mission.
I think, and the alliance, this alliance, you've got Ashwa Bay, kind of stands for Ashland,
Washburn, and Bayfield. It's the whole Shawamigan Bay.
It's the whole Shawamigan Bay, and that's really helped financially, I think, the whole thing, hasn't it?
It really has. You know, we have been really blessed with, Warren and the string band coming up in 1986. They were really the only ones in the area. They had their kind of run of the land because there's nobody else. And now, because of their influence and their doing this over the past 40 years, there's more music in the Shawamigan Bay than I can really think of anywhere else. There's free music during the summer across the South Shore and all the way to Ashland. And you can catch all these amazing artists on any given night in a number of places. So we really feel that through the history and through the education of all this really nurturing of artists, we've really come a long way. And we invite people to come up and really experience the sounds and the excitement around the music scene here in the Shawamigan Bay.
Todd in Racine has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Todd.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks. This is great. I've experienced the Big Top several times, both with my family and friends, but the first time I would say was probably the most memorable. I was running a sailing program on the Dennis Sullivan, which is Wisconsin State flagship. It's now on the East Coast, but we were a tall ship, and we were doing experiential education with teachers, and we ended up in Bayfield. And one of the teachers had a connection with Big Top, and so she connected us up with them, got all of us and the crew in to go see a show, but also somehow recruited me to be a part of the show. And we kicked off the show. I can't remember if I got this right, but there was like a Wizard Water skit that one of the guys did. And so we had sampling equipment on the boat, and we brought water up from the bottom of Lake Superior, and I came and delivered the water to the Wizard Water guy, and it was so funny and it was so cool. But I will say what struck me most about that experience was before the show, the whole group of performers all gathered in a circle and sort of just said their piece and kind of came together, and they let me be part of that. And it was I was hooked. From that moment, I was hooked.
Oh,
so really great.
Wow, what's your caller doing on Friday? I have a dance part if he wants to fill it. He sounds like a great sport. Please come back, Racine.
Thanks. Hey, Gary, that's kind of... you get stories from folks about their experiences?
You know, every night we hear more and more about, generations coming up and experiencing the Big Top. And yes, everyone has their favorite show. Everyone has their favorite act. And so it's really... to hear these stories is really heartwarming, and it makes you come alive. It makes us really look forward to each performance because we know someone's going to be touched by it.
Gary Shaw, Executive Director of the Ashwa Bay Alliance, and Mary Mack, comedian, who will bring her variety show, The Mary Mack and North Star Comedy Hour, to Big Top Chautauqua on Friday, August 8th. You can join in, too. Comment or question. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at Big Top Chautauqua today with our two guests, Gary Shaw, who's Executive Director of the Ashwa Bay Alliance, and Mary Mack, a comedian who's going to be performing on Friday, August 8th, the Mary Mack and North Star Comedy Hour, which sounds like such a hoot. I know it's going to be a lot of fun. And you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. tonightshowwithjimmy.org. Mary, you've also appeared on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and Conan O'Brien and Last Comic Standing. How do you tailor, or do you tailor your sort of Midwest style of humor for this national type audience?
Well, if I'm talking about Menards, I have to say Home Depot instead. And that's the main thing I change. Because, most people, you know, now with the internet and all these shows, they know, they're kind of familiar with the Midwest, but a lot of people don't believe it. Like, I was doing the backstage one time this year on a Wednesday, and on my way home, I almost hit a black bear, you know, on the way home at night, and a lot of performers don't have to deal with those types of obstacles in their career. I mean, that I just nicked them too. It could have been the Don, Mike, you know. So it's a different way of living, but I have such a wealth of wonderful relatives who don't know they're funny to draw from, and also they don't have the internet, so, and they don't often get reception, so we're fine talking about them, Larry. So but it's just the area, you know, the things you do to survive and make your way, and growing up in the woods, I never run out of things to talk about.
And you're also a voice artist. What does that entail?
Well, it's great. You might be in the know on this, Larry, since you do radio, but you don't even have to put makeup on to be a voiceover artist. You just show up in what you got on, and I have a show on Hulu called Solar Opposites, and that's been very popular, and then I have a children's one called Kiff on Disney Plus, and you know, when you're walking, my voice was always a hindrance, I thought, and now I get health insurance from it, and that's unbelievable to me. You know, I was embarrassed of my voice, and here I am. I get to do this big show on Big Top, and I get to do these other TV shows, and I get to still live here in the woods.
Yeah,
it's amazing now, you know.
And you're Larry, really, go ahead.
You should know that she's also an accomplished musician and classically trained.
Yeah, Larry, I have 2 degrees in music. That's why I do comedy.
Oh, my gosh. And you live you really do kind of live in the woods, more or less, don't you?
Yeah. I like going to big cities. Going to Los Angeles because I was sick of people in the Midwest appreciate me for what's on the inside. So when I go there, it solves that problem. And I mean, it's like you can get up in the morning here and go kayaking and then go do your show. So you can't beat that, you know? I love it.
Gary, so this show coming up, and you've got other shows coming up as well, and this month, and we should probably talk about them.
Yeah, let's talk about a bunch of them. We've got obviously Gaelic Storm this Thursday, and Mary on Friday, which will be Mary's show. It's just a hoot. Next week we have Robert Cray, and many people you will know Robert Cray. We're bringing back one of our BCO, our Big Blue Canvas Orchestra shows from a number of years ago. It's called Moon Songs and Moon Shadows. It's the songs of Paul Simon and Cat Stevens. So our house band, which is an amazing, amazing talented group of people, will be doing that both on the 16th and on the 22nd. We have Los Lobos coming on the 23rd. Buena Vista Social Orchestra, that is the generation following the Buena Vista Social Club. So you want to hear some great Cuban songs and music, they will be really an amazing act. And then Mary Mack will take us out of the normal regular season early in September. And then our big closing act is Bonnie Raitt. And we're looking forward to Bonnie Raitt. That is a sold-out show. Not the first time Bonnie's been here. We're welcoming her back to end our season this year.
And isn't there another sort of a music fest, Lake Effect Music Fest or something?
Lake Effect, we are planning. We are going to postpone it until 2026. We just weren't quite there yet. We've done music for 39 years. A music festival is a little bit different animal, and we want to make sure that our patrons really get the best experience. So we're going to look at dates in early 2026 and try our first hand at a music festival. So that will be coming.
And just to mention, last year, Big Top Chautauqua ended production of its Sunday evening show, Big Tent Radio, after 38 years, and it aired on WPR music stations.
It did. It was a great run, a great show. Really featured a plethora of our past artists. We are sorry to see it go, and hopefully sometime in the future we'll see it in another form or another format and have it come back. So we'll keep working on that.
I would hope so. It was really a lot of fun. I always enjoyed listening to it as well. So, Mary, what's in the future for you?
Well, a bunch of gin and tonics after my show is done. Larry, how do you guys do radio every day? I write and write and write for my, you know, I do a series of like three of these shows throughout the summer in different venues. I'm trying to trick Big Top into having me multiple times. But the amount of writing I have to do for this, it's like you guys work really hard in radio. And you know, I tailor my show as if it were a radio show, like the old-time radio variety shows. And you're underappreciated. People need to donate. People need to donate to WPR because you guys work really hard. And I after, you know, making my show bigger and taking on more writing, I really appreciate what you guys do. I forgot what the question was because I got focused on the gin and tonics. Oh, yeah, what's up for me? Well, I'll tell you, you can find my stuff on MaryMacComedy.com, and I have I go on BigTop.org for their tickets, and I got a lot of stuff going on with them. And then I'll do whatever you need me to do. Do you need some janitorial work, Larry? I've trimmed hedges. I've whatever I need to do to make it in comedy.
Well, I tell you what, the street in front of my house is under construction, and they took out about 14 feet of my flower bed. So
No. You
can all come down and you can come down anytime you want and help. Well, you can't do it now because it's still under construction, but maybe next year I'll give you a call and you can come and help me plant flowers.
That's sacrilegious. I've heard you talk about your flower bed so much on this show. How dare they not just put a bend in to go around your place there?
On that note, Mary Mack and Gary Shaw, our guests, as we talk with them about Big Top Chautauqua. Oh, you're going to enjoy your time there. And certainly Mary's show is got to be seen to be believed. I'll put it that way. Thanks to them. And thank you all so much for listening today. It's been a lot of fun. We talked about a variety of things on the show. And it's all thanks to our team, producers Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR.